100 times more powerful. Boosted weapons promised to be smaller and more efficient than those already in the stockpile, producing larger yields with much less fissile material. A full-scale test of the Teller Ulam design took place on November 1, 1952. One of the world's first electronic digital computers had been assembled at Los Alamos to perform many of the necessary calculations. The machine was called MANIAC, Mathematical Analyzer, Numerical Integrator, and Computer, and the device that it helped to create, Mike, looked more like a large cylindrical whiskey still than a weapon of mass destruction. Mike was about 20 feet tall and weighed more than 120,000 pounds. The device was housed in a corrugated aluminum building on the island of Alugalab. When Mike detonated, the island disappeared. It became dust and ash, pulled upward to form a mushroom cloud that rose about 27 miles into the sky. The fireball created by the explosion was 3.5 miles wide. All that remained of Little Alugalab was a circular crater filled with seawater, more than a mile in diameter and 15 stories deep. The yield of the device was 10.4 megatons, roughly 500 times more powerful than the Nagasaki bomb. The Teller Ulam design worked, and the United States now seemed capable of building hydrogen bombs. The war of the future would be one in which man could extinguish millions of lives at one blow, demolish the great cities of the world, wipe out the cultural achievements of the past, President Truman said a couple of months later during his farewell address. Then he added, somewhat hopefully, "Such a war is not a possible policy for rational men." The thought of using nuclear weapons may have seemed irrational to Truman, but a credible threat to use them lay at the heart of deterrence, and planning for their use had become a full-time occupation for many of America's best minds. Fundamental questions of nuclear strategy still hadn't been settled. Project Vista, a top-secret study conducted by the California Institute of Technology, revived the military debate about how to defend Western Europe from a Soviet invasion. In 1950, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, had agreed to create an Allied army with 54 divisions, enough to stop the Red Army, which was thought to have 175 divisions. The European members of NATO, however, failed to supply the necessary troops, and by 1952, the alliance seemed incapable of fielding anywhere near the requisite number. The small U.S. Army contingent in Western Europe served on the front line as a tripwire, a plate glass wall. American troops would be among the first to encounter a Soviet attack, and they'd be quickly overrun, forcing the United States to enter the war. The Strategic Air Command would respond by destroying most of the Soviet Union. But the Red Army would still conquer most of Europe, and civilian casualties would be extraordinarily high. The prominent academics and military officers who led Project Vista, including Robert Oppenheimer, concluded that Sachs' atomic blitz was the wrong response to a Soviet invasion. Bombing the cities of the Soviet Union might provoke a nuclear retaliation against the cities of Western Europe and the United States. Instead of relying on strategic bombing, the members of Project Vista urged NATO to replace manpower with technology, use low-yield tactical atomic weapons against the advancing Soviet troops, and bring the battle back to the battlefield. Such a policy might limit the scale of any nuclear war and save lives, preventing attacks on friendly cities. The field officers of the U.S. Army and the fighter pilots of the U.S. Air Force's Tactical Air Command, TAC, wholeheartedly agreed with those conclusions on humanitarian grounds. They also stood to benefit from any policy that reduced the influence of the Strategic Air Command. As would be expected, Curtis LeMay hated the idea of low-yield tactical weapons. In his view, they were a waste of fissile material, unlikely to prove decisive in battle, and difficult to keep under centralized control. The only way to win a nuclear war, according to Sack, was to strike first and strike hard. Successful offense brings victory. Successful defense can now only lessen defeat, LeMay told his commanders. Moreover, an atomic blitz aimed at Soviet cities was no longer Sack's top priority. LeMay now thought it would be far more important to destroy the Soviet Union's capability to use its nuclear weapons. Soviet airfields, bombers, command centers, and nuclear facilities became Sack's primary targets. LeMay did not advocate preventive war, an American surprise attack on the Soviet Union out of the blue. But the counterforce strategy that he endorsed was a form of preemptive war. Sack planned to attack the moment the Soviets seemed to be readying their own nuclear forces. Civilian casualties, though unavoidable, were no longer the goal. Offensive air power must now be aimed at preventing the launching of weapons of mass destruction against the United States or its allies, LeMay argued. This transcends all other considerations because the price of failure might be paid with national survival. The newly elected president, Dwight D. Eisenhower, had to reconcile the competing demands of his armed services and develop a nuclear strategy that made sense. Eisenhower was well prepared for the job. He'd served as the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe during the Second World War, as Army Chief of Staff after the war, and most recently as the supreme commander of NATO forces. He understood the military challenges of defending Western Europe and the revolutionary impact of nuclear weapons. The Manhattan Project had reported to him until the AEC assumed its role. He had worked closely with LeMay for years and had been briefed by Oppenheimer on the findings of Project Vista. Eisenhower didn't like the Soviet Union, but had no desire to fight a third world war. After being briefed on the details of how Mike had made an island disappear, he privately questioned the need for us to build enough destructive power to destroy everything. After replacing Truman's appointees to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Eisenhower asked his national security team to take a new look at America's defense policies. He'd campaigned for the presidency, vowing to lower taxes and reduce the size of the federal government. Despite his military background, he was eager to cut the defense budget, which had tripled in size during the Truman administration. In June 1953, while a wide range of proposals was being considered, the Soviets crushed a popular uprising in East Germany. 2 months later, they detonated RDS-6, a thermonuclear device. Although the yield of RDS-6 was relatively low and its design rudimentary, the test had ominous implications. Eisenhower was fully committed to preserving the freedom of Western Europe and containing the power of the Soviet Union, without bankrupting the United States. In his view, the simplest, most inexpensive way to accomplish those aims was to deploy more nuclear weapons. And instead of choosing between a strategy based on large thermonuclear weapons or one based on smaller tactical weapons, Eisenhower decided that the United States should have both. In the fall of 1953, the administration's national security policy was outlined in a top-secret document, NSC 162-2. It acknowledged that the United States didn't have enough troops to protect Western Europe from a full-scale Soviet invasion, and it made clear that a Soviet attack would provoke an overwhelming response. In the event of hostilities, the United States will consider nuclear weapons as available for use as other munitions. During his State of the Union address in January 1954, President Eisenhower publicly announced the new policy, declaring that the United States and its allies would maintain a massive capability to strike back. 5 days later, his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, said that the security of the United States would depend on a great capacity to retaliate instantly, by means and at places of our own choosing. The two speeches left the impression that America would respond to any Soviet attack with an all-out nuclear strike, a strategy soon known as massive retaliation. The Air Force and the Strategic Air Command benefited the most from Eisenhower's new look. SAC became America's preeminent military organization, its mission considered essential to national security, its commander reporting directly to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. While the other armed services faced cutbacks in spending and manpower, SAC's budget grew. Within a few years, the number of personnel at SAC increased by almost one-third, and the number of aircraft nearly doubled. SAC's demand for nuclear weapons soared as well, driven by the new focus on counterforce targets. The Soviet Union had far more airfields than major cities, and destroying them would require far more bombs. The Navy's shipbuilding budget stagnated, but the new look didn't inspire another revolt of the admirals. The Navy no longer seemed obsolete. It had gained approval for new aircraft carriers, every one of them equipped to carry nuclear weapons. The Navy also sought high-tech replacements for many conventional weapons: atomic depth charges, atomic torpedoes, atomic anti-ship missiles. Although Eisenhower had served in the Army for nearly 40 years, the Army suffered the worst budget cuts, quickly losing more than one-fifth of its funding and about one-quarter of its troops. General Matthew B. Ridgway, the Army Chief of Staff, became an outspoken critic of massive retaliation. Ridgway had demonstrated great leadership and integrity while commanding ground forces during the Second World War and in Korea. He thought that the United States still needed a strong army to fight conventional wars, that an over-reliance on nuclear weapons was dangerous and immoral, that Eisenhower's policy would needlessly threaten civilians, and that national fiscal bankruptcy would be far preferable to national spiritual bankruptcy. Ridgway's unyielding criticism of the new look led to his early retirement. The Army, however, found ways to adapt. It lobbied hard for atomic artillery shells, atomic anti-aircraft missiles, atomic landmines. During secret testimony before a congressional committee, one of Ridgway's closest aides, General James M. Gavin, later spelled out precisely what the Army required: 151,000 nuclear weapons. According to Gavin, the Army needed 106,000 for use on the battlefield and an additional 25,000 for air defense. The remaining 20,000 could be shared with America's allies. At Los Alamos and Sandia, a crash program had been launched to make hydrogen bombs long before it was clear that the Teller-Ulam design would even work. A six-day week became routine, and the labs were often busy on Sundays as well. The goal was to produce a handful of H-bombs that the Air Force could use if Western Europe were suddenly invaded. Unlike the fission bombs being manufactured at factories across the United States, these emergency capability weapons would be assembled by hand at Sandia and then stored nearby at Site Able. Their components weren't required to undergo the same field testing as those used in the stockpile's other bombs. While Teller and Ulam wrestled with the theoretical issues of how to sustain thermonuclear fusion, the engineers at Sandia faced a more practical question: how do you deliver a hydrogen bomb without destroying the aircraft that carried it to the target? The latest calculations suggested that an H-bomb would weigh as much as 40,000 pounds, and the only American bomber large enough to transport one to the Soviet Union, the B-36, was too slow to escape the blast. The Air Force investigated the possibility of turning the new medium-range B-47 jet bomber into a pilotless drone. The B-47 would be fitted with a hydrogen bomb and carried to the Soviet Union by a B-36 mothership. Codenamed Project Brass Ring, the plan was hampered by the cost and complexity of devising a guidance system for the drone. Harold Agnew, a young physicist at Los Alamos, came up with a simpler idea. Agnew was an independent, iconoclastic thinker from Colorado who'd been present at some of the key moments in the nuclear age. As a graduate student at the University of Chicago, he'd helped Enrico Fermi create the first man-made nuclear chain reaction in 1942. Agnew subsequently worked on the Manhattan Project, flew as a scientific observer over Hiroshima when Little Boy was dropped, snuck his own movie camera onto the plane, and shot the only footage of the mushroom cloud. He'd helped to construct Mike and watched it detonate from a ship 30 miles away, amazed to see the island disappear. The heat from the blast kept growing stronger and stronger, as though it might never end. While thinking about how to deliver an H-bomb safely, Agnew remembered seeing footage of Nazi tanks being dropped from airplanes by parachute. He contacted a friend at the Air Force and said, "We've got to find out how they did that." The Air Force had already taken an interest in those parachutes. Theodore W. Nacke, their inventor, had been brought to the United States after the Second World War as part of a top-secret effort to recruit Nazi aerospace and rocket scientists. The program, known as Project Paperclip, had been run by Curtis LeMay, who later explained its aims: rescue those able and intelligent Jerrys from behind the barbed wire and get them going in our various military projects and feed them into American industry. Theodore Nacke now worked for the U.S. Navy at an air base in El Centro, California. Agnew promptly flew to California, met with Nacke, and asked, hypothetically, if he could design a parachute strong enough to bear the weight of something that weighed 40,000 pounds. "Oh yes," Nacke replied. "No problem." Inspired by the German designs, Project Caucasian, a collaboration between the Air Force and Sandia, developed a three-parachute system that would slow the descent of a hydrogen bomb and give an American bomber enough time to get away from it. The bomb would be dropped by a B-36 at an altitude of about 40,000 feet. A small pilot chute would open immediately, followed by a slightly larger extraction chute. The first two chutes would protect the bomb from being jerked too violently, and then the third chute would open, an enormous ribbon parachute, Theodore Nacke's invention, with narrow gaps in the fabric that let air pass through it and prevented the whole thing from being torn apart. The hydrogen bomb would float gently downward for about 2 minutes, just a tiny little speck in the sky, and then it would explode, roughly a mile and a half above the ground. Bob Purifoy led the team at Sandia that designed the arming, fusing, and firing mechanisms for the emergency capability weapons. Radar fuses promised to be the most accurate means of detonating the bombs, but pinpoint accuracy wasn't essential for a weapon expected to have a yield of about 10 megatons. Klaus Fuchs had most likely given the Soviet Union information about the Archies and other radar fuses used on atomic bombs, raising concern that the Soviets could somehow jam those radars and turn America's H-bombs into duds. A barometric switch or a mechanical timer seemed a more reliable way to trigger the X-unit, fire the detonators, and set off a thermonuclear explosion. Each of those fuses, however, had potential disadvantages. If a mechanical timer was used and the main parachute failed, the bomb would plummet to the ground and smash to pieces before the timer ran out. But if a barometric switch was used and the main parachute failed, the bomb would fall to the designated altitude too fast and explode prematurely, destroying the B-36 before it had a chance to escape. Purifoy asked the Air Force to consider the risks of the two fuses and then make a choice. One fuse might fail to detonate the bomb, the other might kill the crew. When the Air Force couldn't decide, Purifoy ordered that both fuses be added to the firing mechanism. The decision could be made before the bomb was loaded on the plane, with or without the crew's knowledge. Sandia was no longer a small offshoot of Los Alamos. It now had more than 4,000 employees, state-of-the-art buildings with blast walls for work on high explosives, and a year-round test site in the California desert. Plans were underway to open another division in Livermore, California, where the Atomic Energy Commission had recently established a new weapons laboratory to compete with Los Alamos. The University of California managed the labs at Livermore and Los Alamos, but Sandia was a non-profit corporation operated by AT&T. The mix of public and private management, of academic inquiry and industrial production, helped to form a unique insular culture at Sandia, rigorous, grounded, and pragmatic, eager to push the boundaries of technology, yet skeptical of wild and abstract schemes. Highly motivated, collegial, and patriotic. Nobody took a job at Sandia in order to get rich. The appeal of the work lay in its urgency and importance, the technical problems to be solved, the sense of community inspired by the need to keep secrets. Most of the engineers, like Purifoy, were young. They couldn't tell their friends, relatives, or even spouses anything about their jobs. They socialized at the Coronado Club inside the gates of Sandia, hiked and skied the nearby mountains, conducted experiments on new fuses and detonators and bomb casings. They perfected America's weapons of mass destruction so that those weapons would never have to be used. The thermonuclear device that had vaporized Aluga Lab was too large to be delivered by plane. And that type of device presented a number of logistical challenges. Mike's thermonuclear fuel, liquefied deuterium, had to be constantly maintained at a temperature of minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit. Although the feasibility of liquid-fueled hydrogen bombs was being explored, weapons that used a solid fuel, such as lithium deuteride, would be much easier to handle. On March 1, 1954, a solid-fueled device named Shrimp was tested at a coral reef in the Bikini Atoll. The code name of the test was Bravo, and the device worked. But miscalculations at Los Alamos produced a yield much larger than expected. The first sign that something had gone wrong was detected at the firing bunker on the island of Enyu, 20 miles from the explosion. While awaiting the blast wave, the lead scientist in the bunker, Bernard O'Keefe, grew concerned. He was hardly the nervous type. The night before the Nagasaki raid, he'd violated safety rules and secretly changed the plugs on Fat Man's master firing cable. In 1953, after an implosion device mysteriously failed to detonate at the Nevada test site, he'd climbed 200 feet to the top of the shot tower and pulled out the firing cables by hand. Now, he felt uneasy. About 10 seconds after Shrimp exploded, the underground bunker seemed to be moving. But that didn't make any sense. The concrete bunker was anchored to the island, and the walls were 3 feet thick. "Is this building moving, or am I getting dizzy?" another scientist asked. "My God, it is," O'Keefe said. "It's moving." O'Keefe began to feel nauseated, as though he were seasick, and held onto a workbench as objects slid around the room. The bunker was rolling and shaking, he later recalled, like it was resting on a bowl of jelly. The shock wave from the explosion, traveling through the ground, had reached them faster than the blast wave passing through the air. Shrimp's yield was 15 megatons, almost 3 times larger than what its designers had predicted. The fireball was about 4 miles wide, and about 200 billion pounds of coral reef and the seafloor were displaced, much of it rising into a mushroom cloud that soon stretched for more than 60 miles across the sky. 15 minutes after the blast, O'Keefe and the 8 other men in his firing crew tentatively stepped out of the bunker. The island was surrounded by a dull gray haze. Trees were down. Palm branches were scattered everywhere. All the birds were gone. 20 miles from ground zero. O'Keefe noticed that the radioactivity level on his dosimeter was climbing rapidly. A light rain of white ash that looked like snowflakes began to fall. Then pebbles and rocks started dropping from the sky. The men ran back into the bunker, slammed the door shut, detected high levels of radioactivity within the bunker, and after a few moments of confusion, turned off the air conditioning unit. Inside, the radiation levels quickly fell, but outside they continued to rise. The men were trapped. The dangers of radioactive fallout had been recognized since the days of the Manhattan Project, but never fully appreciated. A nuclear explosion produces an initial burst of gamma rays, the source of radiation poisoning at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The blast also creates residual radiation, as fission products and high-energy neutrons interact with everything engulfed by the fireball. The radioactive material formed by the explosion may emit beta particles, gamma rays, or both. The beta particles are relatively weak, unable to penetrate clothing. The gamma rays can be deadly. They can pass through the walls of a house and kill the people inside it. Some elements become lethal after a nuclear explosion, while others remain harmless. For example, when oxygen is bombarded by high-energy neutrons, it turns into a nitrogen isotope with a half-life of just 7 seconds, meaning that within 7 seconds, half of its radioactivity has been released. That's why a nuclear weapon exploded high above the ground. An airburst, like the detonations over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, doesn't produce much radioactive fallout. But when manganese is bombarded by high-energy neutrons, it becomes manganese 56, an isotope that emits gamma rays and has a half-life of 2.5 hours. Manganese is commonly found in soil, and that's one of the reasons that the groundburst of a nuclear weapon can create a large amount of deadly fallout. Rocks, dirt, even seawater are transformed into radioactive elements within the fireball, pulled upward, carried by the wind, and eventually fall out of the sky. The early fallout of a nuclear blast is usually the most dangerous. The larger particles of radioactive material drop from the mushroom cloud within the first 24 hours, landing wherever wind or rain carries them. On the ground, radiation levels steadily increase as the fallout accumulates. Unlike the initial burst of gamma rays from a nuclear explosion, the residual radiation can remain hazardous for days, months, or even years. A dose of about 700 rentgens is almost always fatal to human beings, and that dose need not be received all at once. Radiation poisoning, like a sunburn, can occur gradually. Gamma rays are invisible, and radioactive dust looks like any other dust. By the time a person feels the effects of the radiation damage, nothing can be done to reverse it. Delayed fallout poses a different kind of risk. Minute particles of radioactive material may be pulled into the upper atmosphere and travel thousands of miles from the nuclear blast. Most of the gamma rays are emitted long before this fallout lands, but a number of radioactive isotopes can emit beta particles for long periods of time. Strontium-90 is a soft metal, much like lead, with a radioactive half-life of 29.1 years. It is usually present in the fallout released by thermonuclear explosions. When strontium-90 enters the soil, it's absorbed by plants grown in that soil, and by the animals that eat those plants. Once inside the human body, strontium-90 mimics calcium, accumulates in bone, and continues to emit radiation, often causing leukemia or bone cancer. Strontium-90 poses the greatest risk to children and adolescents whose bones are still growing. Along with cesium-137, a radioactive isotope with a half-life of 30 years, it may contaminate agricultural land for generations. In 1952, Mike's thermonuclear explosion had deposited high levels of fallout in the ocean near the test site. The following year, New York milk tainted with strontium-90 was linked to the detonation of fission devices at the Nevada test site. But the unanticipated size of shrimp's yield, the volume of coral reef and seafloor displaced, and the stronger-than-expected winds combined to produce an amount of fallout that surprised everyone involved with the Bravo test. Thousands of scientists and military personnel, watching the detonation from ships 30 miles away, were forced to head below decks and remain there for hours amid stifling heat. O'Keefe and his men had to be rescued by helicopter. They taped bedsheets over every inch of their bodies before fleeing the bunker, trying to avoid any contact with the fallout. Seaplanes evacuated an Air Force weather station 153 miles from Ground Zero, and 2 days after the blast, the Navy removed scores of villagers from the island of Ronjalap in the Marshall Islands. The villagers had seen the brilliant explosion 115 miles in the distance, but had no idea the white dust that later fell from the sky might be harmful. It settled on their skin and in their hair. They walked barefoot in it for hours. About 80 of them got radiation sickness. Many also developed burns, lesions, and discolored pigment from beta particles emitted by the fallout on their skin. And Ronjalap was blanketed with so much of the white dust that the island's residents weren't allowed to return there for 3 years. The dangers of fallout were inadvertently made public when a Japanese fishing boat, the Lucky Dragon, arrived at its home port of Yaizu 2 weeks after the Bravo test. The 23 crew members were suffering from radiation poisoning. Their boat was radioactive, and so was the tuna they'd caught. The Lucky Dragon had been about 80 miles from the detonation, well outside the military's exclusion zone. One of the crew died, and the rest were hospitalized for 8 months. The incident revived memories of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, sparking protests throughout Japan. When Japanese doctors asked for information about the fallout, the American government refused to provide it, worried that details of the blast might reveal the use of lithium deuteride as the weapon's fuel. Amid worldwide outrage about the radiation poisonings, the Soviet Union scored a propaganda victory. At the United Nations, the Soviets called for an immediate end to nuclear testing and the abolition of all nuclear weapons. Although sympathetic to those demands, President Eisenhower could hardly agree to them, because the entire national security policy of the United States now depended on its nuclear weapons. The fate of the Lucky Dragon was soon forgotten, but the Bravo test led to an alarming realization at the weapons laboratories, the Pentagon, and the White House. Fallout from a hydrogen bomb was likely to kill far more people than the initial blast. At the Atomic Energy Commission, the fallout pattern from the Bravo test was superimposed on a map of the northeastern United States, with Washington, D.C. as ground zero. According to the map, if a similar 15-megaton ground burst hit the nation's capital, everyone in Washington, Baltimore, and Philadelphia could receive a fatal dose of radioactivity. Residents of New York City might be exposed to 500 Rentgens, enough to kill more than half of them. People as far north as Boston or even the Canadian border might suffer from radiation poisoning. The British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was disturbed by the results of the Bravo test. Churchill had been an early proponent of defending Western Europe with nuclear weapons, not conventional forces. In 1952, Great Britain detonated a fission device, and its first atomic bomb, the Blue Danube, had recently been transferred to the Royal Air Force. The Blue Danube, with a yield of about 16 kilotons, now appeared minuscule and obsolete. With all its horrors, the atomic bomb did not seem unmanageable as an instrument of war, Churchill told the House of Commons a month after the Bravo test. But the hydrogen bomb carries us into dimensions which have been confined to the realms of fancy and imagination. A small, densely populated nation would be especially vulnerable to such a weapon. Churchill asked William Strath, an official at the Central War Plans Secretariat, to lead a top-secret study of what a thermonuclear attack would do to the United Kingdom. Strath submitted his report in the spring of 1955, and its findings were grimly apocalyptic. According to the latest intelligence, a Soviet assault on the United Kingdom would have three main objectives. Destroy the airfields hosting U.S. or British bombers, destroy the British government, and render the U.K. useless as a base for any form of military operations. That would be relatively easy to accomplish. The heat flash from one hydrogen bomb, the Strath report noted, would start in a built-up area anything up to 100,000 fires, with a circumference of between 60 to 100 miles. If the Soviets detonated 10 hydrogen bombs along the west coast of the United Kingdom, the normally prevailing winds would blanket most of the country with fallout. Almost one-third of the British population would be killed or wounded immediately. Most of the nation's farmland would be rendered unusable for 2 months. Some of the most productive land might be lost for a long time, and supplies of drinking water would be contaminated. In a section entitled Machinery of Control, the report warned that society would collapse in much of the United Kingdom. Local military commanders would be granted drastic emergency powers, and civil order might have to be restored through the use of rough-and-ready methods. Strath urged the government to release accurate information about the hydrogen bomb so that families could build fallout shelters, store canned foods, and prepare for the worst. The Strath report was kept secret, its plea for greater openness ignored. Instead, Prime Minister Churchill ordered the BBC not to broadcast news about the hydrogen bomb that might discourage the public. Telling the truth about nuclear weapons, the British government feared, would weaken popular support for a defense policy that required them. Churchill had already chosen a different sort of response to the threat of thermonuclear war. Influence depended on possession of force, he told advisers, not long after the Bravo test. Great Britain would develop its own hydrogen bombs. Once again, the appeal of the H-bomb lay in its symbolism. We must do it, Churchill explained. It's the price we pay to sit at the top table. The Eisenhower administration also struggled with how to handle public fears of the hydrogen bomb. The head of the Atomic Energy Commission, Louis Strauss, waited almost a year to acknowledge that the Bravo test had spread lethal fallout across thousands of square miles. While Strauss tried to limit publicity about the dangers of fallout, the Federal Civil Defense Administration, FCDA, conveyed a different message. Val Peterson, the head of the FCDA, advised every American family to build an underground shelter right now. Once the Soviets deployed their hydrogen bombs, Peterson added, we had all better dig and pray. The FCDA had argued for years that people could survive a nuclear attack by seeking some form of shelter. An animated character, Bert the Turtle, urged America's schoolchildren to duck and cover, to hide under classroom tables or desks as soon as they saw the flash of an atomic bomb. And a widely distributed civil defense pamphlet, Survival Under Atomic Attack, provided useful and encouraging household tips. Your chances of surviving an atomic attack are better than you may have thought. Even a little material gives protection from flash burns, so be sure to dress properly. We know more about radioactivity than we do about colds. Keep a flashlight handy. Avoid getting wet after underwater bursts. Be careful not to track radioactive materials into the house. The destructive power of the hydrogen bomb forced civil defense planners to alter their recommendations. Suburban families were advised to remain in underground shelters, windowless basements, or backyard trenches for 4 or 5 days after a thermonuclear blast. Urban families were told to leave their homes when an attack seemed likely. Eisenhower's plans for an interstate highway system were justified by the need to evacuate American cities during wartime. Val Peterson called for concrete pipelines to be laid alongside the new roads so that refugees could sleep inside them and avoid fallout. Duck and cover, one journalist noted, was being replaced by a new civil defense catchphrase: run for the hills. Hoping to boost morale and demonstrate that a nuclear war would not mean the end of the world, the FCDA staged Operation Alert 1955 during June of that year. It was the largest civil defense drill in the nation's history. During a mock attack, 61 cities were struck by nuclear weapons, ranging in yield from 20 kilotons to 5 megatons. As air raid sirens warned that Soviet bombers were approaching, 15,000 federal employees were evacuated from Washington, D.C. The president and members of his cabinet were driven to secret locations and remained there for 3 days. Throughout the United States, families climbed into shelters or rehearsed their escape routes. In New York City, everyone was cleared from the streets and kept indoors for 10 minutes, bracing for the arrival of a Soviet hydrogen bomb, whose ground zero, for some reason, would be the corner of North 7th Street and Kent Avenue in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Administration officials called Operation Alert a great success. The Secretary of the Treasury, George M. Humphrey, said that the exercise demonstrated the United States would be able to take it and recover surprisingly rapidly. Out of a U.S. population of about 165 million, only 8.2 million people would be killed and 6.6 million wounded, and more than half of those casualties would be in New York City. If everybody took the right precautions, Val Peterson assured reporters, we might, ideally, escape without losing any lives from fallout. In a public statement, Eisenhower said the drill had brought him great encouragement, but at a cabinet meeting, he summed up his feelings in one word: staggering. On the first day of Operation Alert, the president had declared martial law, transferring power from state governments to half a dozen army field commands. The casualty figures released to the press vastly understated the likely impact of a thermonuclear war. A new word had entered the lexicon of nuclear war planning: megadeath. It was a unit of measurement. One megadeath equaled 1 million fatalities, and the nation was bound to suffer a great many megadeaths during a thermonuclear war. On January 23, 1956, President Eisenhower recorded in his diary the results of a top-secret study on what would really happen after a Soviet attack. The United States experienced practically total economic collapse, which could not be restored to any kind of operative conditions under 6 months to a year. Members of the federal government were wiped out, and a new government had to be improvised by the states. It was calculated that something on the order of 65% of the population would require some sort of medical care, and in most instances, no opportunity whatsoever to get it. Eisenhower was infuriated by the Army's constant requests for more troops to help defend Western Europe. It would be perfect rot to talk about shipping troops abroad when 15 of our cities were in ruins, he told an aide. The Army would be needed at home to deal with the chaos. You can't have this kind of war, Eisenhower said at a national security meeting a couple of years later. There just aren't enough bulldozers to scrape the bodies off the streets. Part 3. Accidents will happen. Acceptable risks. 3 weeks after winning an Oscar for Best Actor in The Philadelphia Story, Jimmy Stewart enlisted in the Army. It was the spring of 1941, long before Pearl Harbor, but Stewart thought the United States would soon be at war and wanted to volunteer his skills as a pilot. The previous year, he'd failed an Army physical for being 10 pounds underweight. This time he passed, just barely, and at the age of 32 entered the Army Air Corps as a private. By 1944, Major Jimmy Stewart was flying the lead plane in bombing runs over Germany. While other Hollywood stars like Ronald Reagan and John Wayne managed to avoid combat during the Second World War, Stuart gained a reputation in the 8th Air Force as a lucky commander who always brought his men back from dangerous missions. He flew dozens of those missions, shunned publicity about his wartime exploits, and never discussed them with his family. He always maintained a calm demeanor, a fellow officer recalled. His pilots had absolute faith in him and were willing to follow him wherever he led. After the war, Colonel Jimmy Stuart returned to Hollywood and starred in a series of well-received films: It's a Wonderful Life, Harvey, Rear Window, while serving in the Air Force Reserve. Deeply concerned about the Soviet threat, he decided to make a movie about the importance of America's nuclear deterrent. Stuart visited SAC headquarters in 1952 to discuss the idea with General Curtis LeMay. The two had met in England while serving in the 8th Air Force. LeMay gave the project his blessing, worked closely with the screenwriter Baron Lay Jr., and allowed the film to be shot at SAC air bases. Strategic Air Command was released in 1955. It tells the story of a Major League infielder, Dutch Holland, whose baseball career is interrupted when the Air Force returns him to active duty. For most of the film, Holland, played by Jimmy Stewart, is torn between his desire to enjoy civilian life and his duty to protect the United States from a Soviet attack. Strategic Air Command focuses on the hardships endured by SAC crews, the dangers of their job, the sacrifices that overseas assignments imposed on their families. Even the bubbly, upbeat cheer of the actress June Allison, playing Stewart's wife, is briefly deflated by the challenges of being married to a SAC officer. Shot in Technicolor and widescreen VistaVision, featuring spectacular aerial photography and a rousing score, the film offers an unabashed celebration of American air power. "She's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life," Stewart says, at his first glimpse of a new B-47 bomber. More compelling than the film's plot, the on-screen chemistry between Allison and Stewart, or the footage of SAC bombers mid-flight, was the performance of actor Frank Lovejoy as General Ennis C. Hawks. Gruff, unsentimental, fond of cigars, unwilling to tolerate mistakes, and ready at a moment's notice to unleash a massive retaliation, the character was a flattering, barely fictionalized portrait of Curtis LeMay. It was another demonstration of SAC's skill at public relations. LeMay had already become a national celebrity, a living symbol of American might. Life magazine described him as the toughest cop of the Western world and repeated an anecdote about his boundless self-confidence. Warned that if he didn't put out his cigar, the bomber he was sitting in might explode, LeMay replied, "It wouldn't dare." The premiere of Strategic Air Command was held in New York's Times Square, with searchlights piercing the sky and more than 3,000 guests, including Air Force generals, politicians, businessmen, Hollywood starlets, and Arthur Godfrey in the lobby of the Paramount Theater, broadcasting the event live on television. Godfrey was a popular radio and television personality, as well as a good friend of LeMay's, who frequently promoted SAC during his shows. Strategic Air Command was one of the highest-grossing films of 1955. It fit the national mood. And a few years later, Jimmy Stewart, as a member of the Air Force Reserve, was appointed Deputy Director of Operations at SAC, one of the top jobs at the command. Behind the public facade of invincibility, questions were secretly being raised at the Pentagon about whether SAC could survive a Soviet attack. LeMay had spent years building air bases overseas, in Greenland, Great Britain, Spain, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, and Japan, where his planes would begin and end their bombing missions against the Soviet Union. But a study by the RAND analyst Albert Volstetter suggested that a surprise attack on those bases could knock SAC out of the war with a single blow, leaving the United States defenseless. LeMay felt confident that sort of thing would never happen, that his reconnaissance planes, flying daily missions along the borders of the Soviet Union, would detect any unusual activity. Nevertheless, he accelerated SAC's plans to base most of its aircraft in the United States and to refuel them en route to Soviet targets. And LeMay continued to demand perfection from his officers. Training in SAC was harder than war, one of them recalled. It might have been a relief to go to war. The town of Rhinelander, Wisconsin, became one of SAC's favorite targets, and it was secretly radar-bombed hundreds of times, thanks to the snow-covered terrain resembling that of the Soviet Union. By 1955, the SAC battle plan called for 180 bombers, most of them departing from the United States, to strike the Soviet Union within 12 hours of receiving an emergency war order from the president. But constant training and the radar bombing of Wisconsin could not guarantee how air crews would perform in battle with real weapons. During tests at the Bikini Atoll in May 1956, the Air Force got its first opportunity to drop a hydrogen bomb from a plane. The 3.8-megaton weapon was carried by one of SAC's new long-range B-52 bombers, with the island of Namu as its target. The B-52 safely escaped the blast, but the bombardier had aimed at the wrong island, and the H-bomb missed Namu by 4 miles. Withdrawing most of SAC's planes from overseas bases did not, however, eliminate the threat of a surprise attack. The continental United States, codenamed the Zone of the Interior, ZI, was also considered highly vulnerable to Soviet bombers. During Operation Tailwind, 94 SAC bombers tested the air defense system of the ZI by approaching from Canada, flying at night, and using electronic countermeasures to simulate a Soviet raid. Only 7 of the planes were spotted by radar and shot down. The failure to intercept the other 87 planes raised the possibility of a devastating attack on the United States. Now that the Soviets had hydrogen bombs and jet bombers, the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended a large investment in America's air defense and early warning system. General LeMay strongly disagreed with that proposal, arguing that in the nuclear age it made little sense to waste money playing defense. If the Soviets launched an attack with 200 bombers and American forces somehow managed to shoot down 90% of those planes, the United States would still be hit by at least 20 H-bombs, if not more. Instead of air defense, LeMay wanted every available dollar to be spent on more bombs and more bombers for the Strategic Air Command, so that Soviet planes could be destroyed before they ever left the ground. His stance gained support in Congress after the Soviet Union demonstrated its new long-range jet bomber, the Bison, at Moscow's Aviation Day in 1955. 10 Bisons flew past the reviewing stand, turned around, flew past it again in a new formation, and tricked American observers into thinking that the Soviet Air Force had more than 100 of the planes. The CIA predicted that within a few years the Soviets would be able to attack the United States with 700 bombers. Democrats in the Senate, led by presidential hopeful Stuart Symington, claimed that the Soviets would soon have more long-range bombers than the United States, raised fears of a bomber gap, and accused the Eisenhower administration of being weak on defense. It is clear that the United States and its allies, Symington warned, may have lost control of the air. Defying Eisenhower, Congress voted to appropriate an extra $900 million for new B-52s. The Soviet Union's bluff had an unintentional effect. It widened the bomber gap, much to the benefit of the United States. By the end of the decade, the Soviet Union had about 150 long-range bombers, and the Strategic Air Command had almost 2,000. Despite serious doubts that the United States could ever be protected against a nuclear attack, work began on an air defense and early warning system. At the very least, the Joint Chiefs concluded, Such a system would provide a reasonable degree of protection for the essential elements of the war-making capacity: SAC bases, naval bases, command centers, and nuclear weapons storage sites in the ZI. The Army erected batteries of Nike anti-aircraft missiles to defend military installations and American cities. The Navy obtained radar-bearing picket ships and built Texas Towers to search for Soviet bombers approaching over the ocean. The picket ships lingered about 500 miles off the coast of the United States. The Texas Towers were moored to the seafloor, like oil platforms, closer to shore. The Air Force assembled squadrons of jet fighter interceptors, like the F-89 Scorpion, and developed its own anti-aircraft missile, the Bomarc, infuriating the Army, which had traditionally controlled the nation's anti-aircraft weapons. More important, the Air Force started to build a distant early warning, DEW line of radar stations 200 miles north of the Arctic Circle. Stretching from the Aleutian Islands off Alaska, across Canada to Greenland, the DEW line was supposed to scan the polar route from the Soviet Union and provide at least 2 hours' warning of an attack. It was later extended west to Midway Island in the Pacific and east to Mormont Hill in Scotland, a distance of about 12,000 miles. Its construction required the transport of almost 500,000 tons of building materials into the Arctic, where thousands of workers labored in temperatures as low as minus 70 degrees Fahrenheit. A sense of urgency pervaded the effort. The United States seemed completely unprotected against Soviet planes carrying hydrogen bombs. Begun in February 1955, construction of the DEW line's 57 Arctic radar stations, some of them featuring radio antennae 40 stories high, airstrips more than a mile long, and housing for the civilian and Air Force personnel who manned the facilities around the clock, was largely completed in about 2.5 years. Through an agreement with the Canadian government, the North American Air Defense Command, NORAD, was organized in 1957 with its headquarters in Colorado Springs, Colorado. NORAD's mission was to provide early warning of an attack and mount a defense against it. If Soviet bombers were detected approaching North American airspace, fighter interceptors would be sent to shoot them down as far as possible from the United States. Anti-aircraft missiles would be fired at enemy planes that managed to get past the interceptors. First Bomarc missiles, then Nike. Coordinating the many elements of the system during an attack would be an extraordinarily complex task. Signals would be arriving from picket ships, Texas towers, DEW line sites, airborne radars. Hundreds of Soviet bombers might have to be spotted and followed, their positions sent to anti-aircraft batteries and fighter bases separated by thousands of miles. During the Second World War, Army radar operators had tracked enemy planes and used shared information about their flight paths verbally. That sort of human interaction would be impossible if large numbers of high-speed bombers approached the United States from different directions. The Air Force proposed a radical solution: automate the system and transfer most of its command and control functions to machines. The computerization of society, the technology writer Frank Rose later observed, was essentially a side effect of the computerization of war. America's first large-scale electronic digital computer, ENIAC, had been built during the 1940s to help the Army determine the trajectory of artillery and anti-aircraft shells. The war ended before ENIAC was completed, and its first official use was to help Los Alamos with early calculations for the design of a thermonuclear weapon. Los Alamos later relied on the more advanced MANIAC computer and its successor, MANIAC II, for work on the hydrogen bomb. Driven by the needs of weapon designers and other military planners, the U.S. Department of Defense was soon responsible for most of the world's investment in electronic computing. At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, researchers concluded that the Whirlwind computer, originally built for the Navy as a flight simulator, could be used to automate air defense and early warning tasks. Unlike computers that took days or weeks to perform calculations, the Whirlwind had been designed to operate in real time. After extensive testing by the Air Force, an updated version of the Whirlwind was chosen to serve as the heart of the semi-automatic ground environment, SAGE, a centralized command and control system that linked early warning radars directly to anti-aircraft missiles and fighter interceptors, that not only processed information in real time, but also transmitted it, that replaced manpower with technology on a scale reminiscent of pulp science fiction. It was the first computer network. Built during roughly the same years as the Dew Line, SAGE consisted of 24 direction centers and 3 combat centers scattered throughout the United States. The direction centers were enormous 4-story windowless blockhouses that housed a pair of AN-FSQ-7 computers, the first mainframes produced by IBM. They were the largest, fastest, and most expensive computers in the world. Each of them contained about 25,000 vacuum tubes and covered about 1/2 acre of floor space. Analog signals from early warning radar sites were converted into digital bits and sent via AT&T's telephone lines to SAGE direction centers, where the huge computers decided whether an aircraft was friend or foe. If it appeared to be an enemy bomber, the computers automatically sent details about its flight path to the nearest missile batteries and fighter planes. Those details were also sent to NORAD headquarters. Human beings would decide whether or not to shoot down the plane. But that decision would be based on information gathered, sorted, and analyzed by machines. In many respects, SAGE created the template for the modern computer industry, introducing technologies that would later become commonplace: analog-to-digital conversion, data transmission over telephone lines, video monitors, graphic displays, magnetic core memory, duplexing, multiprocessing, large-scale software programming, and the light gun, a handheld early version of the mouse. The attempt to create a defense against Soviet bombers helped to launch a technological revolution. Although dubious about the usefulness of SAGE, General LeMay thought that SAC's command and control system needed to be improved as well. He wanted to know where all his planes were at all times, and he wanted to speak with all his base commanders at once if war seemed imminent. It took years to develop those capabilities. When SAC's Strategic Operational Control System, SOCS, was first unveiled in 1950, its teletype messages didn't travel from one base to another with lightning speed. During one early test of the system, they were received almost 5 hours after being sent. And it could take as long as 1/2 hour for the American Telephone and Telegraph Company to make the SOCS circuits operable. That sort of time lag would make it hard to respond promptly to a Soviet attack. Transmission rates gradually improved, and the system enabled LeMay to pick up a special red telephone at SAC headquarters in Omaha, dial a number, gain control of all the circuits, and make an announcement through loudspeakers at every SAC base in the United States. The introduction of single sideband radio later allowed him to establish voice communications with SAC's overseas base commanders and with every one of its bomber pilots mid-air. The amount of information constantly streaming into SAC headquarters from airplanes and air bases throughout the world led to the creation of an automated command and control system that used the same IBM mainframes developed for SAGE. The system was supposed to keep track of SAC's bombers in real time as they flew missions. But until the early 1960s, the information displayed at SAC headquarters stubbornly remained anywhere from 1.5 hours to 6 hours behind the planes. All of these advances in command and control could prove irrelevant, however, if SAC's commander didn't survive a Soviet first strike. General LeMay's attitude towards civil defense was much the same as his view of air defense. I don't think I would put that much money into holes in the ground to crawl into, he once said. I would rather spend more of it on offensive weapons systems to deter war in the first place. Nevertheless, the plans for SAC's new headquarters building included an enormous command bunker. It extended 3 levels underground and could house about 800 people for a couple of weeks. One of its most distinctive features was a wall about 20 feet high, stretching for almost 50 yards, that was covered by charts, graphs, and a map of the world. The map showed the flight paths of SAC bombers. At first, airmen standing on ladders moved the planes by hand. The information was later projected onto movie screens. A long curtain could be opened and closed by remote control, hiding or revealing different portions of the screens. It gave the underground command center a hushed, theatrical feel, with rows of airmen sitting at computer terminals beneath the world map and high-ranking officers observing it from a second-story glass-enclosed balcony. While ordinary families were encouraged to dig fallout shelters in their backyards, America's military and civilian leadership was provided with elaborate, top-secret accommodations. Below the East Wing at the White House, a small bomb shelter had been constructed for President Roosevelt during the Second World War, in case the Nazis attacked Washington, D.C. That shelter was expanded by the Truman administration into an underground complex with 20 rooms. The new bunker could survive the airburst of a 20-kiloton atomic bomb. But the threat of Soviet hydrogen bombs made it seem necessary to move America's commander-in-chief someplace even deeper underground. At Raven Rock Mountain in southern Pennsylvania, about 80 miles from the White House and 6 miles from Camp David, an enormous bunker was dug out of solid granite. Known as Site R, it sat about half a mile inside Raven Rock and another half a mile below the mountain's peak. It had power stations, underground water reservoirs, a small chapel, clusters of 3-story buildings set within vast caverns, and enough beds to accommodate 2,000 high-ranking officials from the Pentagon, the State Department, and the National Security Council. Although the bunker was huge, so was the competition for space in it. For years, the Air Force and the other armed services disagreed about who should be allowed to stay there. The president could also find shelter at Mount Weather, a similar facility in the Blue Ridge Mountains near the town of Berryville, Virginia. Nicknamed High Point, the bunker was supposed to ensure the continuity of government. It would house Supreme Court justices and members of the cabinet, as well as hundreds of officials from civilian agencies. In addition to making preparations for martial law, Eisenhower had secretly given 9 prominent citizens the legal authority to run much of American society after a nuclear war. Secretary of Agriculture Ezra Taft Benson had agreed to serve as administrator of the Emergency Food Agency. Harold Beschenstein, the president of the Owens Corning Fiberglass Company, would lead the Emergency Production Agency. Frank Stanton, the president of CBS, would head the Emergency Communications Agency. And Theodore F. Koop, a vice president at CBS, would direct the Emergency Censorship Agency. High Point had its own television studio, from which the latest updates on the war could be broadcast nationwide. Patriotic messages from Arthur Godfrey and Edward R. Murrow had already been pre-recorded to boost the morale of the American people after a nuclear attack. Beneath the Greenbrier Hotel in White Sulphur Springs, West Virginia, a bunker was built for members of the Senate, the House of Representatives, and hundreds of their staff members. Known as Project Greek Island, it had blast doors that weighed 25 tons, separate assembly halls in which the House and Senate could meet, decontamination showers, and a garbage incinerator that could also serve as a crematorium. A bunker was later constructed for the Federal Reserve at Mount Pony in Culpeper, Virginia, where billions of dollars in currency were stored, shrink-wrapped in plastic, to help revive the post-war economy. NATO put its Emergency Command and Control Center inside the Kinzbach Cave, an underground complex in West Germany with 67 rooms. The cave had previously served as a Nazi military headquarters for the Western Front. The British government had planned to rely on a series of deep underground shelters built in London during the Second World War, but the Strath report suggested the need for an alternate seat of government far from the capital. In the Wiltshire countryside, about 100 miles west of London, a secret abandoned aircraft engine factory hidden inside a limestone mine was turned into a Cold War bunker larger than any in the United States. Known at various times by the codenames Subterfuge, Burlington, and Turnstile, it was large enough to provide more than 1 million square feet of office space and house almost 8,000 people. Although the original plans were scaled down, the completed bunker had miles of underground roads, accommodations for the Prime Minister and hundreds of other officials, a BBC studio, a vault where the Bank of England's gold reserves could be stored, and a pub called the Rose and Crown. During the closing months of the Truman administration, the Joint Chiefs of Staff had once again asked for control of America's nuclear weapons, and once again their request had been denied. But the threat of Soviet bombers and the logistical demands of the new look strengthened the arguments for military custody. By keeping the weapons at half a dozen large storage sites, the Atomic Energy Commission maintained centralized civilian control of the stockpile. The arrangement minimized the risk that an atomic bomb could be stolen or misplaced. Those AEC sites, however, had become an inviting target for the Soviet Union, and a surprise attack on them could wipe out America's nuclear arsenal. The Joint Chiefs argued that nuclear weapons should be stored at military bases and that time-consuming procedures to authorize their use should be scrapped. Civilian custody was portrayed as a grave threat to readiness and national security. A democratic principle that seemed admirable in theory could prove disastrous in an emergency. According to the AEC's rules, if the Strategic Air Command wanted to obtain the nuclear cores of atomic bombs, the President of the United States would have to sign a directive. Local field offices of the AEC and the Department of Defense would have to be notified about that directive. Representatives of those field offices would have to contact the AEC storage sites. Once the proper code words were exchanged, keys would have to be retrieved, storerooms unlocked, nuclear cores carried outside in their metal containers. At best, SAC would get the cores in about 12 minutes, but the process could take a lot longer. Local officials might have to be tracked down on vacation or awakened in the middle of the night. They might have to be persuaded that this was the real thing, not a test. In June 1953, President Eisenhower approved the shipment of nuclear cores to American naval vessels and overseas bases where the other components of atomic bombs were already stored, and where foreign governments had no authority to dictate how the bombs might be used. Cores were removed from the AEC stockpile, placed under military control, and shipped to sites that met those criteria: American naval vessels and the island of Guam. The following year, the Joint Chiefs of Staff asked for permission to store bomb components and nuclear cores at SAC bases. Dispersing the weapons to multiple locations, the Pentagon argued, would make the stockpile much less vulnerable to attack. The AEC didn't object to handing over more nuclear cores. The chairman of the commission, Louis Strauss, agreed with most of LeMay's strategic views, and the new general manager of the AEC, General Kenneth Nichols, had not only argued for years that the military should control America's atomic bombs, he'd pushed hard for dropping them on Chinese troops during the Korean War. President Eisenhower allowed the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force to start moving nuclear cores to their own storage sites, both in the United States and overseas. But his faith in military custody had its limits. Eisenhower insisted that the AEC retain control of the cores for all of the nation's hydrogen bombs, even during an emergency. No active capsule will be inserted in any high-yield weapon, the new rules stated, except with the expressed approval of the AEC custodian and in the custodian's presence. Civilian employees of the Atomic Energy Commission were posted on aircraft carriers, ammunition ships, and air bases where H-bombs were stored. These AEC custodians were supposed to keep the cores securely locked away and hold on to the keys until the president ordered them to do otherwise. But the Joint Chiefs considered this arrangement inconvenient, largely symbolic, and an insult to the military. Secretary of Defense Charles Wilson agreed, and in 1956 the AEC custodians were withdrawn from ships and air bases. Instead, President Eisenhower allowed the captains of those Navy ships and the commanders of those Air Force bases to serve as designated Atomic Energy Commission military representatives. And they were given the keys to the nuclear storerooms. Legally, the hydrogen bombs were still in civilian custody. But in reality, after nearly a decade of unrelenting effort, the military had gained control of America's nuclear weapons. The Navy carried them on ships in the Atlantic, the Pacific, and the Mediterranean. The Strategic Air Command stored them at air bases in the ZI and overseas, at Homestead in Florida and Ellsworth in South Dakota, at Carswell in Texas and Biggs in South Carolina, at Plattsburgh in New York and Castle in California, at Whiteman in Missouri, Schilling in Kansas, and Pease in New Hampshire, at Fairford, Lakenheath, Greenham Common, Brize Norton, and Mildenhall in Great Britain, at Nusur, Ben Gurir, and Sidi Slimane in French Morocco, at Torrejon and Moron and Zaragoza in Spain, at Kadena in Okinawa, and at least 19 other locations. Atomic bombs and hydrogen bombs had been liberated from civilian oversight and scattered throughout the world, ready to be assembled by military personnel. For safety reasons, the nuclear cores and the bomb components were stored separately. On naval vessels, they were kept in different rooms. At SAC bases, they were kept in different bunkers, shielded by earthen berms and walls 10 feet thick. The storage bunkers, known as igloos, were located near runways, by order of the Joint Chiefs, to provide rapid availability for use and reduce the possibility of capture. In addition to gaining custody of nuclear weapons, the military also assumed a much larger role in their design. The AEC's authority had been diminished by a revision of the Atomic Energy Act in 1954 and by an agreement signed the previous year with the Department of Defense. A civilian agency that had once enjoyed complete control over the stockpile became, in effect, a supplier of nuclear weapons for the military. The Army, Navy, and Air Force were now customers whose demands had to be met. The AEC labs at Livermore and Los Alamos aggressively competed for weapon contracts, giving the armed services even greater influence over the design process. The rivalry between the two labs became so intense that at times their dislike for each other seemed to exceed their animosity toward the Soviet Union. When Livermore's first three designs for hydrogen bombs proved to be duds, it was an expensive setback to America's weapons program, but a source of much amusement at Los Alamos. As the number of storage sites multiplied, so did the need for weapons that were easy to assemble and maintain. Ordinary enlisted men would now be handling hydrogen bombs. The weapons in the stockpile during the mid-1950s were much simpler than the first generation of atomic bombs, and yet they still required a good deal of maintenance. Their batteries were large and bulky and could hold a charge for only about a month. When a battery died, the bomb had to be taken apart. After the battery was recharged, the bomb had to be reassembled and its electrical system had to be checked. One of the final steps was a test to make sure that all the detonators had been properly connected. If the detonators didn't work, the bomb would be a dud. But if they were somehow triggered by the maintenance procedure, the bomb could go off. On at least three different occasions during the 1950s, the bridge wire detonators of nuclear weapons were set off by mistake during tests of their electrical systems. These accidents occurred during training exercises, and none resulted in the loss of life. But they revealed a worrisome design flaw. An error during routine maintenance or hurried preparations for war could detonate an atomic bomb. Bob Purifoy led a team at Sandia that was trying to create a wooden bomb, a nuclear weapon that wouldn't require frequent maintenance or testing, that could sit on a shelf for years, completely inert, like a plank of wood, and then be pulled from storage, ready to go. Purifoy had heard about a new kind of battery that didn't need to be recharged. Thermal batteries had been invented by a Nazi rocket scientist, Georg Otto Erb, for use in the V-2 missiles that terrorized Great Britain during the Second World War. Erb revealed how the batteries worked during an interrogation by American intelligence officers after the war. Instead of employing liquid electrolytes, a thermal battery contained solid ones that didn't generate any electricity until they reached a high internal temperature and melted. Purifoy thought that thermal batteries would be an ideal power source for a nuclear weapon. They were small, rugged, and lightweight. They had a shelf life of at least 25 years, if not longer. And they could produce large amounts of current quickly, after being ignited by an electric pulse. The main drawback of a thermal battery, for most civilian applications, was that it couldn't be reused or recharged. But Purifoy didn't consider that to be much of a problem, since the batteries in a nuclear weapon needed to work only once. At about the same time that thermal batteries were being added to America's atomic and hydrogen bombs, another important design change was being developed at Los Alamos. A weapon boosted by tritium and deuterium gas would use much less fissile material to produce a large explosion. Right before the moment of detonation, these hydrogen gases would be released into the weapon's core. When the core imploded, the gases would fuse, release neutrons, multiply the number of fissions, and greatly increase the yield. And because the fissile core would be hollow and thin, a lesser amount of explosives would be needed to implode it. As a result, boosted weapons could be light and small. The first widely deployed hydrogen bomb, the Mark 17, was about 25 feet long and weighed roughly 40,000 pounds. The Mark 17 was so big and heavy that the Air Force's largest bomber could carry only one of them.